You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up with a surge in COVID-19 cases around the country, demand for tests has gone way up. That's opening the door to con artists using fake websites and suspicious in-person testing sites to collect people's private data. Look at how those scams work and how people can avoid them. Now, ballot drop boxes became big news during and after the 2020 elections. The first-year surge of the coronavirus pandemic caused a lot more people than usual to request absentee ballots, and drop boxes offered a major convenience for returning them. But the legality of these boxes is a question that's been bouncing around through our court system. Earlier this month, a Waukesha County Circuit Court judge ruled that drop boxes couldn't be used. Monday of this week, an appeals court ruled they could be used, but only for our upcoming February election. Today, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty is asking the Wisconsin Supreme Court to negate that appeals court ruling. Meanwhile, there's a split among Republicans in the state legislature over future rules for absentee ballot drop boxes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you use one of these drop boxes in the 2020 election or any election? How did you find that experience? Are you in favor of these drop boxes? Opposed? Do you think that if we use them, we need statewide rules established? There's an effort in the state legislature to do that. Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Philip Chen is assistant professor of political science at Beloit College. He's an expert in political psychology, behavior, and communication. Phil, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, drop boxes, these absentee ballot drop boxes, they weren't new in 2020, but I think they were new to a lot of people in 2020. Can you talk about the dramatic rise in these things getting used?
Of course. You're right. They were not new. They have been used in a variety of places around the country prior to 2020, but not very extensively in Wisconsin. You know, if you look at 2016, it was really just a handful of places that had ballot drop boxes in the 2016 election, and probably even fewer in 2018. They really didn't become an important conversation, piece of the electoral conversation until 2020, with the rise in absentee ballot requests with the coronavirus pandemic.
Now here in Wisconsin, there's no law specifically allowing these drop boxes. There's also no law specifically banning these drop boxes. Is this kind of a weird legal situation?
It's a legal situation that is sort of obviously, as we're discussing, in flux, right? It's been taken through the court system. The courts have not yet decided on what the legality is. We do have, of course, guidance from the Elections Commission, which says during 2020, they said that these were allowed and with a certain set of stipulations. It remains to be seen. The expectation is that this will end up at the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And at that point, I think we'll have an idea of what is allowed under current law. Of course, as you mentioned, there are already efforts underway in the state legislature to potentially codify some laws around ballot drop boxes.
I want to talk about the short run here. We have primary nonpartisan elections already next month, not necessarily hugely on people's radar. Big question is, can we use boxes then? A judge says no. An appeals court says yes. Supreme Court, we don't know yet. Do we tend to see courts not want to make big changes when you're knocking on the door of an election?
Yeah, courts tend to not want to make changes. Exactly right. And I think if you look at some of the reasoning from the District 4 Court of Appeals, was essentially they said that the decision by the circuit court in Waukesha was too close to the election, that there may have been people who have already dropped their ballots into drop boxes, and that the court is sort of just historically, not just Wisconsin courts, but courts in general are wary of sort of wading into political questions like this so close to an election. They don't like to have that impression of influencing the outcome of an election. So part of the sort of District 4 reasoning for saying this is purely about their decision was limited to the February 15th primary was to say, this is what, 20 some days off. We don't want to make changes to what people are expecting to do or maybe have already done this close to an election.
Talking to Phil Chen from Beloit College, looking at absentee ballot drop boxes here in Wisconsin. Big in 2020, big controversy since then. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want them used, used commonly, not used at all? Do you want statewide guidelines on how they're used, if they're used? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Phil, I mentioned a big controversy surrounding these things. They weren't that controversial pre-2020. Accusations from Republicans, especially from former President Trump, that they opened the door to something, to some kind of fraud. Do we know if they've been particularly risky as we look back on this election?
We do know that they are not risky really at all, that there's no evidence to suggest that they are a risk to ballot security. They are, there are very tight guidelines about how they are structured. So every ballot drop box is under 24-hour surveillance, either by an individual or by cameras. They are securely locked. They are emptied every day. So there's no evidence that ballot drop boxes are insecure. In many ways, they may be more secure than putting your ballot in your home mailbox and putting the flag up. Anyone can come by and look in your mail. I mean, it's a federal crime, but you know, in some sense, many people actually felt that they were more secure. And there's no evidence to suggest that they are liable for fraud. In fact, they probably are just as secure as dropping it in a U.S. mail drop box and sending your ballot in that way.
And when that ballot arrives with the local election officials, the absentee ballot mailed in, the absentee ballot dropped off in a drop box, they're basically the same once they get to that clerk's office, right? They go through the same double checks?
Yeah, absolutely. There's no, there's no unique pathways for ballots received by mail versus ballots received in the drop box. They're treated as absentee ballots, similar to if you were to fill out your absentee ballot and go to your city clerk and drop it off with your city clerk. They go into the processing for absentee ballots. And, you know, one of the big discussions coming into the election was what we call pre-processing. Wisconsin doesn't, I don't believe, allows any kind of pre-processing. So it's not even that these could be counted ahead of time. They are simply stored until they are counted on the day of the election.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Todd is with us on the road by Wausau. Todd, hi.
Hi, how you doing today?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Todd?
Well, I'm not really in favor of drop boxes in terms of, unless there's some stringent rules around them and regulations and laws. And here's why. Even though people say that it doesn't open it up to fraud, I think it does. Because there's so many other things happening. You know, in a lot of other states, we've got early voting. We've got, and all these other things that are happening. I just want to ensure that, A, the ballot that's in the box is really from a registered voter that has been verified by ID. I voted by mail last time in the election, and we had to upload our ID in our county that we were in. We had to go through some stringent tests in order to get the ballot. I want access for people. But quite frankly, I don't believe that we are disenfranchising anybody. And I don't know that this is the route to go.
Todd, thanks for the call. Todd doesn't see harm if we don't have the drop boxes, given that, as he said, we've got other options, in-person early voting, mail absentee voting. Phil, is it really that bad if we didn't have that drop box option?
Well, that's one of those things that I think we just don't have the data at this point to know. What we do know is that part of the popularity around drop boxes was that, coupled with the pandemic, the U.S. mail system was incredibly slow, was slowed down. And because of rulings around when ballots can be when ballots have to be received in order to be counted in Wisconsin, if you got your ballot and you just didn't have a chance to fill it out until a few days before the election, you should not have put it in the mail, because it would not have gotten to your, it almost certainly would not have gotten to your county clerk in time for it to be counted. So ballot drop boxes also became popular because it was a way to ensure that your ballot was in the hands of election officials by sort of cutting out the postal service as the sort of the transit system. But I think it should be pointed out that, you know, I think the concern is there, but the way to get your ballot that you would then drop into a drop box is exactly the same as the caller's method of getting his for mail-in voting, that you still have to upload a copy of your ID in order to receive your absentee ballot, which you would then place into the drop box. So in some sense, because these drop boxes are monitored by either an individual or a camera, there's actually more steps in place to ensure that if you needed to check, the person dropping off a ballot is the person who requested it. They still have to get the ballot the same way that somebody who votes by mail does.
Thanks for the call, Todd, at 800-642-1234. Phil Chen is with us, political scientist at Beloit College. We'll get some of the latest news around ballot drop boxes, which at this point, still pending another court challenge, are going to be used in the February primary. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you work in or around elections? What impact have you seen absentee ballot drop boxes have? If you are a voter, do you like having this option? Do you not like it? Call in at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Phil Chen, assistant professor of political science at Beloit College, looking at some of the legal back and forth this month surrounding the use of ballot drop boxes in the state. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Phil, before we go back to our callers, I want to check in on the state legislature now, a committee drafting pretty far-reaching election changes for Wisconsin's future, including saying, yeah, we can have drop boxes. Here are how many you can have in your community. Here are the security precautions you have to take. It went on a conservative website, got a backlash from former President Trump, and it's kind of a tizzy among state legislative Republicans. What do you see going on within the Republican Party here in the state on the issue?
So I think what we see in the Republican Party is this kind of attempt to in some sense, market themselves around ballot security or election security, but still trying to balance what could potentially get passed and finding that sort of middle ground that may even get, say, signed by the governor. Of course, depending on how stringent the regulations are in the law, it very well might be vetoed by the governor. So I think what you're seeing is kind of this conflict, right? Is there a segment of the Republican Party that wants to say, yes, let's take this seriously here. Let's put forward this set of guidelines or these set of laws around elections versus the side that says, that it's all about election fraud, and anything that has been sort of associated rhetorically with the 2020 election is inherently bad. And so I think you're seeing this kind of tension within the party as to which direction they want to take their messaging on something like election security.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Nate is with us in Milwaukee. Nate, hi.
Hi, thank you. I used ballot Dropbox to vote in the last couple of elections. I thought it worked great. I've voted that way both when they actually had an elections person manning a great big, basically bin that had a lid with a split on it so that people would put it on, and also for the specific box itself. And I thought it worked great. I thought it was secure. And a lot of people may not realize it, but there's a tracking number on the ballots that get mailed out to people. And I was able to use that to double check and make sure that my ballot was registered as picked up and taken in. So I think it was actually very secure, and I'm glad it's an option. I think the Wisconsin Institute of Law and Liberty is basically out there trying to limit people's liberty in terms of how they turn in their ballots.
Nate, thanks for the call. Phil, Nate enjoyed his ballot box experience and appreciate the ability to track his ballot, which you can also do, I believe, with mail-in absentee ballots.
Yep, you can. And I think this would be sort of one of the concerns that political scientists would have, which is that certain types of voting behavior, voting absentee, voting with drop boxes, voting in person even, can be habit forming. And that's really good. We want to encourage people to vote. So moving away, restricting the ways that people can access the electoral system can be sort of a shift in habit and shift, and that shift can cause people to be less likely to vote. And so even though somebody still has to request an absentee ballot and they have to fill it out, but now they say can't drop it off, they have to put it in the mail, that might lead some people who had gotten in this habit of dropping them in a drop box to say, well, you know, this is a lot of work, or they forget about it, or it sits in a pile and suddenly it's not sent in on time. So, you know, from sort of a psychological standpoint of what we know about voting behavior, rolling back options for people to vote can be a shift in habit and can make it a little bit more difficult for people to vote.
Nate, thanks for the call. Go to Don now in Wauwatosa. Don, hi. Not hearing you, Don. Oh, that's okay. We'll go to Travis then in Green Bay. Travis, hi.
Hi. Thank you for my call. And wondering if a voter requests a ballot online, submits it in a drop box, and then goes and votes in person and submits a ballot there, how do they prevent two votes from getting counted?
Travis, thanks for that call. I think a common question, Phil, and that's our earlier caller, Nate, was talking about. There's a tracking number on your ballots, and you only get one of them counted.
Yep, you only get one counted. And in fact, when you show up at the if you were to have requested your absentee ballot and then showed up at your polling place, it would show up on the voter rolls that they have at the at your polling place that you have already received your absentee ballot. What you can do is if you bring your unfilled out absentee ballot, so if you had requested it and then you said, oh, I didn't get a chance to fill it out, I want to just vote in person, you can bring your unfilled out absentee ballot. And there are ways to essentially turn that in and get a new one. If you don't have it and you show up and you are marked as having received your absentee ballot, you can cast what's called a provisional ballot. But there's if you were to cast a ballot through absentee, through the mail or through a drop box, and then show up, you simply wouldn't get your ballot because you would have already been listed within the voter rolls as having received your ballot.
Travis, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Philip Chen, assistant professor of political science at Beloit College, looking at absentee ballot drop boxes here in the state. Working the way through the courts now as to whether we'll be able to use them in next month's nonpartisan primary elections, and then more court cases in the future on the same topic. State lawmakers working on the issue, whether to have drop boxes, if so, if we need statewide regulations. Still time for your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Phil, there's, as we mentioned, some controversy even among Wisconsin Republicans on this. Do you think we're going to get through this to a point where drop boxes are going to be just kind of a normal part of the landscape in two or three elections from now?
I mean, I think a lot of it is going to depend on what ultimately the state Supreme Court decides. I doubt that if a Republican-backed election security bill, unless drop boxes are a specific standalone bill, it's unlikely that you're going to have Democratic support, including from the governor. So that is probably not likely to become law anytime soon. But we will have to see what the Supreme Court decides on ballot drop boxes. If they decide that they are allowed under the Wisconsin Election Commission's guidelines, then yes, I think we'll probably see this as kind of a natural part of the electoral landscape. If they don't, it will really come down to what the legislature and the governor can agree on as far as regulations. So I think, you know, I think it remains to be seen, depending on what we see from the state Supreme Court.
Time for one more quick call. Susan is with us in New Berlin. Susan, hi.
Hi. I'm a poll worker in New Berlin, and you were talking about the Dropbox. What if somebody puts their ballot in the Dropbox and then comes in and tries to vote? We already have it in those big books that everybody jokes about. It already says that they've already sent in a vote. But if it doesn't say it and they think that they may not have dropped it off and might have lost it, they can actually vote provisionally, and it's marked that way, and it's double-checked by machine and by human, probably four humans, to make sure that no other vote has come through. So there is no way to vote twice.
Susan, thanks for clarifying that. Phil, backs up what you said earlier. In just our last minute, do you think people should feel safe about the existence of these absentee ballot drop boxes?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think the evidence is clear that there is no reason to be concerned about your ballot security in ballot drop boxes. I don't think we've seen any evidence whatsoever that they are not secure in any way, shape, or form.
Thanks for that call, Susan. And Phil, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Always happy to be here.
That's Philip Chen, assistant professor of political science at Beloit College. He was with us today to talk about the use of absentee ballot drop boxes here in Wisconsin. There's a back and forth going on in the courts. One judge said, no, can't use them, not even in next month's nonpartisan primary election. Appeals court says, we're going to put a stay on that. Boxes are back in. A court challenge going to the state Supreme Court now looking to have them say, no, you can't. Follow all of those twists and turns with our news team over at WPR.org. Catch up on the latest news about ballot drop boxes and other election issues. And, of course, you can still share your thoughts over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, the big fish eats the little fish in the world of high-tech business. Find out what large-scale mergers in the technology industry mean for the products that you use and the prices you pay for them. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. There's a piece of information going on around online. You might have seen it or heard about it. It seems suspicious at first glance, a made-up news story maybe. But a fact-checking website got on the case, and it turns out to be true about Scooby-Doo. The legend, the piece of info going around about the cartoon dog, is that the full name of Scooby-Doo is Scoobert Doo. Well, you could believe it or not, but the fact-checking site Snopes.com is on the case. They found compelling visual and audio evidence by watching lots of Scooby-Doo cartoons that it's true. In one cartoon episode of the series, a pup named Scooby-Doo, Scooby's mom scolds him, calling him Scoobert. Let's check the evidence.
Come on, Scooby, try it on.
Scoobert? Scoobert?
The name pops up elsewhere in the Scooby extended universe. It's not clear that the original creators of Scooby-Doo had the name Scoobert in mind, though. True Scooby-Doo news you can use. This is Central Time. I know we'll catch that feeling. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a WPR reporter takes us to a community-built ice castle that recently opened in Eagle River. Now the spike in COVID-19 cases is leading to a big demand for testing. And in many cases, those tests are hard to come by. So new websites are showing up, and testing sites conducted out of tents and vans have been popping up in cities around the country. Some of them are run by private companies and are perfectly legit. Others, not so much. So you've got to take some caution. Jim Temer is president and CEO of the Better Business Bureau serving Wisconsin. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here. How are you, Rob?
Pretty good. Well, before we get to these scams, Jim, we don't want to discourage people from getting tested. There are a lot of legitimate options out there, right?
Oh, you bet they are. And the best thing and the bottom line is make sure you're going to an authorized test site or health centers. You can visit your local health department if that's the county or the state, tribal, your own healthcare system. You know, give them a call. They may not be able to take you right away, but they might be able to direct you to the correct place. And We just heard, you know, hopefully that the peak is past for this, but we know that as long as COVID's going on, there are going to be scammers trying to take advantage of us. So we want to take care of ourselves. We want to take care of our health and take care of our wallets.
All right. Now let's get to the scams. What kind of things are we seeing out there?
Well, there's two variations of this scam, really online and in person. And the online scam is you may get a text or an email or even a phone message directing you to a website where you can make an appointment to go in and get tested. So they ask for your personal information, your insurance, your medical information, maybe a credit card, because they say there's a small processing fee. So on the day of the appointment, you go where they told you to go. It might be a well-known pharmacy. It might be a healthcare location, and they have no record of it. It was just someone out there phishing, trying to get your personal information, credit card, insurance, anything that they can about you. And you're out of luck because you gave them that. Who knows what they're going to do with it down the line? It's not going to be anything good. And you don't get a test. The other thing we're finding are some of these pop-up sites. And you're right, not all of them are scams. Not all of them are phony. But we just tell people, please be aware and have a grain of salt. We've had reports that you'll make an appointment or you'll just walk in and they'll take a swab and they'll ask again for all sorts of personal information. And the next thing you know, they'll say, well, we'll get back to you in 24 hours. And we've had people say it's been 2-3 weeks and they haven't received any results. And the company is still there. The business is still there doing COVID tests. So will they ever get results? Is this personal information being safeguarded? Is it being used correctly? Or is it a big scam?
So what are some of the red flags of the kind of information they're asking for us to get that test that I think in most cases is supposed to be free, right?
Right. It's free. You should just be able to walk in. Now, you have to be leery, you know, if they're asking for, right, they may say, well, there's some processing fee. There shouldn't be. If they ask for any kind of payment, any kind of credit card to hold something, even if nothing will be charged, it's a red flag. You know, they don't need to have your social security number. Do they need your address? Maybe, but you can ask what they're doing with that information. Also, kind of be aware if you walk into a place and you notice the staff isn't, you know, gowned and masked up properly, another red flag. If it doesn't appear to be a healthcare facility and you know what they're like, you know, these places are clean, they try their best. Our healthcare workers are usually gowned and masked. So you have to look out for what you're doing. Now, we understand the public demand for these tests is high, and there are tests more available now than, say, the last few weeks. But again, scammers through this whole pandemic have been taking advantage of people because they play off of our emotion. So when you're worried, you're upset, you don't know what's going on, you want that test so bad, boy, you will pay for it or you will go anywhere for it. And when people start acting emotionally instead of thinking logically, that's when they get ripped off.
I want to go back online with you now. Scammers are pretty good at making their website look like it might be an official website. One case in point, you know, there is a legit U.S. Postal Service thing where you can go get some free COVID tests mailed to you. Apparently, there are some scams where you get, again, that text or email or whatever that refers you to a site. They've spoofed the USPS logo. How do we figure out that that's not the real deal?
Yep. Well, first of all, it's odd that, the Postal Service or most healthcare organizations, without your knowledge or approval, will not be sending you texts or emails telling you to do stuff. So if you get something out of the blue from someone that you aren't associated with, that also is a red flag. And when you go visit a website, if it's USPS, the United States Post Office, anything governmental will end in .gov. If it ends in .com, it's not officially government. Healthcare things, those will end in .com, but you gotta make sure they're spelled right and they're secure. When you look up in the URL, the address line, for it to be secure, there's either going to be a little padlock logo or it will start with HTTPS, and that S means secure. So if you put any personal information in there, it will be, it will be secure. Also, these pop-up websites, one problem are they're so hard to hunt down, and this goes for all e-commerce, is a website will come up for 2 weeks, it'll go down, it'll come up with a slightly different name, it'll come down, it'll come up somewhere else. So all the information that has gone in there, you can't follow up on it. If you're, you know, looking at things, you want to look at the About Us section. You know, do they have anything in there? Do they have a physical location? Do they have people you can actually contact on the phone if you have problems? Remember, this is something where not only you're going to not get the health information you need. But when you're giving out all your personal information, you're setting yourself up for identity theft and who knows how much money you could lose.
If we encounter a site, either a website or one of these pop-up sites, and we think, wow, this doesn't look legit to me, A, obviously don't give them your information, but B, where can we report this kind of thing?
Well, we are collecting that information at the BBB. Go to BBB, you can go on our scam tracker, you can report it. You can just give us a call or an email and report it. And we share that with law enforcement agencies. Now, this is so new. Again, this has only been going on for the past, not even month, just a couple of weeks, that we've been working across the country. We got BBBs all over and compiling all our information. And actually, we're finding a lot of these places are tied together and they're operating out of Chicago. Now, we're just beginning this investigation stage. And as I said, we share this with the Federal Trade Commission, FBI, anyone else. So if you do have a problem, you do think that you've been scammed, or you stopped because it was a potential scam, let us know. All that information, or if you get a text or a phone call, the phone numbers, even though that stuff changes, anything we can get is beneficial. It's kind of a crowdsourcing way for us to defeat these scammers.
Jim, thanks for joining us again.
Always my pleasure. Stay warm.
You too. That's Jim Temer, President and CEO at the Better Business Bureau serving Wisconsin. We talked to him about a rise of fake COVID-19 testing operations. We've got some tips on how to avoid being scammed. Find them at WPR.org/Central Time. This week, WPR is featuring stories of how the pandemic has been felt by all of us. On today's Wisconsin Life, producer Maureen McCollum brings us a poem about losing a loved one to COVID-19.
Pam Gustafson of Milwaukee loves to write poetry. It helps her process everything she reads and sees in her life.
I call it therapy, because physically I am unable to cry due to an autoimmune disorder.
So when Gustafson's sister, Mary Beth Nolan, died from COVID complications last May, she couldn't cry about it. To grieve, Gustafson wrote a poem.
After her death, I went through a period where I was quite angry because there were so many people who refused to vaccinate. So that's when I wrote, "Dying from COVID is not pretty." It channeled my anger over my sister's horrible death.
Her sister was vaccinated, but she was immunocompromised. Gustafson sent her poem to us through WPR's Wisconsin Project with hopes more people could learn about her sister's experience.
Dying from COVID is not pretty. Dying from COVID is not gentle death. It is a brutal way to die, gasping for breath. I watched my baby sister die this way. She begged for a ventilator every day. She knew a ventilator signaled the end, but her fear and anxiety needed to mend. I saw fear in her eyes and tried to send messages of love to my sister, my friend. Her long hair was matted against her face. Her teeth were black with lots of dried gunk. She had to communicate by trying to write, refused to move her mask, aware of her plight. Imagine gasping for air just to talk. So much fatigue, you cannot walk. Like choking on a piece of food blocking air, or drowning your gasping lungs in despair. And living for weeks on tubes alone, what your body used to do on its own. A catheter to pee, you can't walk to the can. Tired, you can't lift your body for a bedpan. A tube that brings you some nourishment. Your body can't coordinate breath and eating. Now your lungs are deflated, balloons pleading for the air they were used to and needing. Two garden hoses sutured to your neck to remove carbon dioxide waste, to replenish oxygen organs to base. You can't move, there is no food to taste. Imagine writing a note to your sister. This is the last time you will see me. Even though it hadn't crossed my mind, the sight of her struggle was so unkind. She was right, it was the last time. But at that point, I still had hope. But my sister just could not cope. her lungs functioning at 0%. Doctors considered double lung transplant, but my sister wanted to end the struggle. She was constantly thinking, I just can't. I have been short of air for a long month. And on that same note, she wrote to me, was a note to the people who gave her care. Can you put me under, insert the tube? She was suffering, wanted to die, I conclude. For death was her only choice to end her pain. Then her kidneys shut down, her heart waned. They brought her back twice, but it was her will to escape her body, the one that COVID killed.
Pam Gustafson of Milwaukee shares a poem she wrote about her sister, Mary Beth Nolan, who died from COVID-19 complications. Gustafson read that poem at her sister's funeral. Nolan was 59, an educator, a wife, a mother of three, and a grandmother. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Tomorrow, we'll hear from other Wisconsinites about how they've been affected by the COVID-19 pandemic. There's more to come here on Central Time. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. It's really cold around Wisconsin right now, but one winter tradition is back to give us a reason to go outside. Ice castles. There's one open to visitors in Lake Geneva, and another community-built ice castle is open in Eagle River. Rob Menser recently paid the Eagle River Ice Castle a visit. He's WPR's Rural Communities reporter based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob. How are you?
Well, good. Paint us a radio picture, Rob, of the ice castle you saw in Eagle River.
Sure. Well, it's a beaut. It's especially beautiful at night. It is built out of more than 2,000 of these like giant blocks of ice that they harvest out of Silver Lake, and there's a spire in the center that's like 33 feet tall. It's these 10 feet tall walls of ice, and they have it lit up from within at night, and it's right downtown Eagle River, and people come and take photos.
They would do it every year, I think, if they could, but there's some pretty tight parameters, I understand, Rob. What has to work out just right for them to be able to do this?
Right. There's really a tight window. So Eagle River is a snowmobiling capital, as a lot of people know. That's probably what it's maybe best known for, is a place people come from all over the place to go to snowmobile in that area in Vilas County. And every January, they have a world snowmobile tournament that brings thousands of people to town. And that happens in mid-January. And so the goal for the ice castle, that which is built by the fire department and community volunteers, is to have it constructed by the time of that snowmobile tournament, right? So in order to do that, the ice on the lake needs to be at least 12 inches thick by around the new year, and not more than 16 inches thick. So there's like a window in there. I asked also if they what about these snowmobilers? Why don't you could build it? You could still build it in January. And the chief there said that the other thing is that the sun starts to get too powerful by this. You know, if you wait too long, he said one year they built it and it lasted for 4 days. so that's not what you want out of your ice castle.
And this is the first time with those tight conditions, first time it's happened since 2018. How often do they actually get to pull this thing off, given those conditions you just mentioned?
Yeah, I mean, it is not every year thing at all, right? 2018 was the last one. I think that's sort of what the rotation is. It's every few years as opposed to every year. And of course, that does have the effect of it does make it like kind of special. People, the fact that this is an ice castle year gets people's attention, has people like me write stories about it, and a bunch of local news stories will talk about it. And so even people I talked to when I was up there, they said, yeah, you know, this is, I want, we wanted to get up here because this is not a, you know, we don't know when the next time you'll be able to see it is.
And this, there are some for-profit ice castles that happen elsewhere around the country. This is, as you mentioned, a community effort. When you talk to people up there, was there that sense of community pride? Like, yeah, we get together and build this thing?
Right, for sure. So primarily it is a function of the fire department, but they do have their people, you know, just people who pitch in. But even the fire department is a volunteer fire department. So most of those people are volunteering already, their time and energy. It has such a fun history in Eagle River that the town first built an ice castle in 1933. And, there were for a long time in the history of it, there was an ice company. You know, it used to be a business that you could have in Wisconsin, is selling blocks of ice for people's ice boxes. And the C.H. Hanke Ice Company sold the blocks of ice or provided the blocks of ice for the Eagle River Ice Castle. And that guy, Charles Hanke, was the fire chief back in the like 40s and 50s in Eagle River. In the late 80s, it was taken over by the fire department again. Some other organizations have been doing it, by the grandson of Charles Hanke, and who carried it on. His name was Jack Thomas, and now it's done by the current fire chief there. So there's really this kind of like fun community history to it as well.
Talking to Rob Mentzer, WPR reporter, about the Eagle River Ice Castle. It is back this year, first time since 2018. Looking at pictures on this cool website the hipsters are all talking about, Rob, at WPR.org. But something that strikes me is the purple lights, the purple lighting on the ice castle, and that has a significance. Can you tell us about it?
Right. So in Eagle River, a 10-year-old girl named Berkeley Adamovich died in December from a rare cancer, and she had been battling that cancer for over a year. And it was really the community had rallied around her family. One of her parents worked for the county there, and it's a small community. People know each other in Eagle River and in the Northwoods area, and so purple ribbons had become a way of showing support for Berkeley and for her family. So the purple light, which really is pretty, I mean, it really looks nice, mm-hmm. is a nod to and a way of honoring Berkeley.
Now, you mentioned this doesn't last too long once the sun starts shining brighter, Rob. How long is this expected to stay up and open?
Boy, it is hard to say. I don't think that it's likely to have melted much today, for instance.
I guess not, probably, yeah.
So it definitely depends a lot on the sun, but I mean, I think we're talking about weeks, not months, you know what I mean? I think that it starts to, and I'm sort of interested. To me, if I lived closer, I would like to see it sort of like half melted, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I think that'd be kind of fun too. But yeah, I think in its current form, I think that by mid-February it's going to start to show signs of wear.
Now it's a cold day today. I don't know how warm it was when you went to see it, Rob. I mean, do you feel like the coldness kind of radiating off of this thing?
Yeah, it's cold, and there's like a, you can't really go in it, but there's like places to sit, and I was like, no thank you. I don't sit inside these blocks of ice. But people, you know, people take photos and they have trees around it and stuff. So it's cold, but I mean, it's Eagle River. It's already cold. People are cruising in on their snowmobiles and parking, you know, but they're like fully decked out, right? When you have your full bodysuit and eye protection and everything, you know, it's not so cold to you.
Now you're back in Wausau, Rob. What do you think? Could your community borrow this idea? Can we expect Wausau ice castles under your?
I think we could get it.
And you could be the king of the ice castle.
Well, now, see there. Now that appeals to me. There's an idea. I think we could get a. I think we could get an ice castle. I think everybody should do it. Why not? What's stopping you? Everybody should make ice castles.
Maybe not the right amount of ice. Rob, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
All right. Thank you.
That's WPR's rural communities reporter, Rob Mentzer, with us today to talk about a community built ice castle he visited in Eagle River. There's also a fee to see one in Lake Geneva. if you have pictures of an ice castle this year's or from ones in the past, or if you've worked to help build that one in Eagle River, love to hear from you. You can email ideas@WPR.org, post on the Ideas Network Facebook page, check out Rob's reporting, comment while you're there over at WPR.org, and check out those cool pictures. It really does look cool with those purple lights going on there. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, find out what Wisconsinites think about some big national issues, including the U.S. Supreme Court, with a new opening on the bench. That'll be part of our conversation. Share your thoughts, too. It's the new Marquette University Law School survey. We'll be talking more about the Supreme Court opening on the way with the announced retirement of Justice Stephen Breyer. We'll talk about that on the show on Friday. Plus, should he stay or should he go? After a playoff loss and a year of controversy, Packers fans are wondering about the future of Aaron Rodgers and the Packers. We'll check out the story, what people are thinking, and you can join in with your thoughts. What do you want to see happen? That and more, it's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Up next is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we check in on recent worker strikes and the state of organized labor across the country. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.